This is Thomas, a.k.a. a Mad Painter. I'd like you to join me Monday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time for Open Canvas. Don't forget to bring an open mind.
Yes, folks, that's right. Bring an open mind to an open canvas. Again, that is Monday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern. UFOs to government corruption. This is Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. You don't need to expect us. We're already here.
This is the people's war. It is our war. We are the fighters. Fight it, then. Fight it with all that is in us. And may God defend the right.
Warning! Warning!
We've got to stop them! They're going to kill us all!
See how the trouble you've started?
Be they the government, be they industry, be they organized labor, be they anyone or human being.
Time when the operation of the machine becomes so odious, makes you so sick at heart that you can't take part. You can't even passively take part. And you've got to put your bodies upon the gears and upon the wheels, upon the levers, upon all the apparatus, and you've got to make it stop. And you've got to win the day to the people who run it, to the people who own it. That unless you're free, the machine will be prevented from working at all.
Revolution Radio of freedomslips.com, the number one listener-supported talk radio station, throwing ourselves upon the gears of the machine. Revolution Radio, where information never sleeps.
You called down the thunder, well now you've got it.
Red, you tell them I'm coming, and hell's coming with me, you hear? Hell's coming with me!
Revolution Radio!
All right. Thanks for listening while we take that short break here at Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. And now we're going to get back to your host.
Well, hello, everyone. I'm Chuck Gregory. This is the New American Dream Radio Show, and we are streaming live on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. It's a listener-supported network. So make sure that you show them some support. You can support this wonderful network in many different ways. Just head on over to freedomslips.com and look for what you can do to help out. We have a new American dream, not of new homes and toasters and microwaves, but of becoming the type of country we always thought we were. My first guest tonight is Jim Napolitan. Jim is an expert in economics, and he has some very interesting things to say. Normally, he appears live, but for tonight, today's his birthday, so he was kind enough to let me pre-record it yesterday, and here's what he had to say.
Those are located in the gas system. They're no longer viewed you can talk to a hydrologist, but they're no longer viewed as being able to a nuclear reactor that might just handle a whole large industrial project like a Ford Motor Company plant or something like that.
Wow. Okay. Well, that's kind of big. Yeah, much of the Navy, for instance, is nuclear power. So, relatively small reactors are certainly viable.
Yes, and the real work that I mentioned his, I'm not trying to throw people towards his company, but Terra Power is the name of it, is to look for much safer ways that are being developed for them to shut down. If efficiently and safely. You know, that was the problem with Three Mile Island and Fukushima, and Chernobyl, that they didn't have efficient mechanisms.
Yeah.
And I don't know what the deal, what the shutdown arrangement is for this one in the Ukraine that we've been reading about. That's a very important question.
Yes, indeed.
Hello, everyone. I'm back here, and I discovered that we were having some major issues with the audio on the previous segment. I extend my apologies for that, and hopefully I have it adjusted better now. We're our next guest is live. It's Philip Ferruggio, who joins us from Port Orange, Florida. And so we certainly, one second. Okay, sorry about that, folks. All right. Anyway, I'm about to add Philip Ferruggio into the show right now. He's an extremely prolific writer, columnist, and I maintain a website for him called itsTheEmpireStupid.com. Here we go with Philip Ferruggio. Okay, so Philip, hello.
Good evening.
How are you?
All right. How are you?
Well, I've been better. I kind of crashed on my bike the other day.
Again, Tuesday. You crashed on your bike?
Yeah, it was nighttime. And there was a hole in the road. I couldn't until I was on the road.
So what happened? I mean, did you have to get, you know, go to the hospital, or was it just a minor injury?
I've got a black eye and rash on my left arm.
So you didn't go to the hospital, though, did you?
No, I didn't.
Oh, my goodness. I'm so sorry.
Yeah, that's all right.
But you have a case pending, right, with that other accent that the lady that
with
backed the car into you?
With somebody, you know, somebody backed the car into me. Yeah, this,
yeah, that's what I'm saying. So you have a case with that.
It was totally, you know, totally me. And, well, I mean, I suppose if I had, you know, tried, maybe I could have sued the city of Pompano or something. But, you know.
Oh, you mean put a hole in the ground?
Yeah, right. That's... Oh. Like it would have been very successful, so you know, I'm not the suing type. You know, that's just not.
Yeah, I know. So anyway, we're on the air now, right?
We are on the air. So
oh, we're on the air. Okay, I didn't know. All right, you want to hear my column?
Enough about us. Let's hear your column.
Actually, the way you read the other one, maybe you should read the columns and I'll just comment. You know.
You like that.
Anyway. Well, this one you can. This is a short one.
Okay.
So it's all over now. By the way, next week I'm going to be talking about 9/11. You know, the anniversary. Okay. But this is called "It's All Over Now, Baby Red, White, and Blue."
Nah.
And the song lyrics were from Dylan. The vagabond who's rapping at your door is standing in the clothes that you once wore. Strike another match, go start anew, and it's all over now, baby blue. Those are the lyrics from Bob Dylan's great It's All Over Now, Baby Blue, 1965. How appropriate they are now in America, 2022. We have finally become a damaged empire due to a mega variety of reasons. Foremost is the delusion of far too many of us that we are a nation victimized by forces of terror outside of our influence. Well, anyone who takes the time to turn away from the narcotics of electronic gadgetry, 24-hour sports, sexual delights, addictive cigarettes, alcohol, and other drugs of preference, along with the mainstream media's embedded with empire phony news, they would then see that our nation is a role model for terrorism. As we float aimlessly into the narrow straits of both national and individual economic turmoil, even bankruptcy, the movers and shakers of this empire laugh all the way from their well-secured gated communities to their banks and investment houses. Can this all be a dream, as many Eastern philosophies teach? After all, could George Orwell have written a better story with the main character, a jaded reality television star, becoming president? How about all those lemmings who thought that the Gordon Gekko character in Oliver Stone's film Wall Street was sacrosanct in his belief that greed is good? So too, those with not even a pot to piss in, following almost religiously a billionaire so-called populist demagogue who peddled that same crap. He did not drain the swamp, rather filling it with more super-rich greed-is-good muck. Yet it only shows how much our American populace can continue to take from an enema bag overloaded with, well, we who love the country we grew up in and see through this two-party, one-party con job have a civic duty to stand up and say no more. One afternoon a few short years ago, as my 85-year-old peace activist friend John and I stood outside of our local library holding signs in protest of this military-industrial empire, a lady from Germany came up to us. She complimented us on our activism, and she made a cogent point. She said, "You know, you Americans have so much to be angry with concerning this government and its phony wars. Yet there are only two of you standing out here each week. If this was Germany and my country did what yours had done, there would be literally 1,000 people out here with you." Well, it seems that my fellow citizens have become too comfortable living in this feudal society. Psychologists refer to this kind of mindset as that of enabling. How many Apple Annies must be selling on the street corners of our nation before we all get wise? Thank you. By the way, Apple Annie, if people listening don't remember or they're too young to understand, I mean, I'm too young too, but during the Great Depression, when things were so bad and people were out of work, there were people on the street corner selling apples. Yeah, they're selling fruit, but apples was the popular thing.
Right.
Selling apples in the fancy part of town, in the theater district. Called the women, they used to call them Apple Annies. So that's where that comes from.
Huh.
And, you know, I think, Chuck, when you see the slew of these telemarketing calls that all of us get, and I have 3 phone lines in my home office, so I get 3 times as many as other people. And there are so many of these telemarketing calls, and it's really sad because the majority of the people who are making the calls aren't even very well educated and well trained. But basically, because things are not good, you know, even though they might talk about how everything is great, things are not good. And that's why they have to make all these telemarketing calls to try to, you know, get more business. So I think that's an indication how things are not going so good, you know?
Yeah.
I don't know whether you agree with me, but that's how I feel.
Yeah, that's pretty much. I was actually just looking through because I was I usually follow your columns on the website so I can refer back to things to talk about it. And on this one, it appears that what you read was not all on the website.
So oh, really?
Yeah, you're going to have to send me
resend that.
Yeah. And update it.
That was April. That was written in April. No, it was written. I'm sorry, it was written on July 4th. This piece I just wrote 2 months ago. Yeah, but I'll send it to you again.
Wasn't it written July 4th of last year?
No. I wrote it this past July 4th.
I guess I didn't send it
because it was so short. Maybe that's why I didn't send it.
Called It's All Over Now, Red, White, and Blue.
Yeah.
From July 6, 2021.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So, anyway, what I did.
It's an interesting little glitch. You know, that pretty much happened.
Yeah, well, maybe I just kind of redid it on July 4th again. That's what I probably did.
Maybe so. And maybe I don't have the update. So maybe I'll post it as an update. Figure that out later. Anyhow.
Go ahead.
It's very powerful. And,
Dylan, it's powerful. Yeah, it is powerful. I didn't realize it, how powerful it is. But, you know, now it's 9/11 coming up. 9/11 is coming up this coming Sunday.
Yeah.
It's the anniversary. Now, we have a couple of minutes left. Do you remember where you were on the morning of 9/11? 2001?
I was home. And I got a call from Lorraine because she was out and she told me turn on the TV, there's something amazing happening. Have to go to war or something.
Yeah.
That's about what we all thought at the time.
Yeah, I was working out of my home office and one of my neighbors happened to call me and said, turn on your TV. Yeah, I mean, you know, same thing. You know, a plane went into the Twin Towers. I think he called me after the first plane.
Mm.
And so, you know, and then, of course, we all know what happened.
Yeah.
Well, we don't. No, I shouldn't say that.
I know what happened.
Yeah, I know what happened. But I don't think a lot of people really know what happened. You know, I mean, I have, as you know, from talking to me over the years, I have my own belief. Well, not my belief. I've been, studying this, reading a lot of books and stuff. You know, to me, it was a false flag operation.
Mm-hmm.
And, anyway, there are two schools of thought. One is the worst case. One is the not so worst case scenario.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the worst case scenario is that there were elements within our own government that instigated it, instigated it to happen, and allowed. And then the other one is there are elements in our government that knew that it was going to happen and allowed it to happen. So those are the two schools of thought. And if you read 9/11, The New Pearl Harbor by David Ray Griffin, who wrote a really good book on it. And, there's a lot of research. I'm sure you've heard of, but, a lot of people that Mike Palachek was into it a lot, you know, the whole conspiracy. And then there's other crazy conspiracy, which we won't talk about now, about holograms and all that stuff.
Uh-huh.
And that, that just takes away, that takes away from the truth.
Exactly.
And it's like, yeah, it's like the people who are, who were behind this in some way like that, because it, then it makes everybody, you know, everything's all over the place, all the craziness. But, you know, basically, I'm sorry, go ahead.
It, well, it's the too much information and disinformation approach.
You just throw
out so many things, and you know, probably somewhere buried in there, some of them might be true, but mostly you just keep everybody completely confused because you have too many possibilities that aren't even possible. To discredit the people that have really done their research.
When the 9/11 commission had their whatever you call it, and they had the it was a Democrat, the one of the attorneys who was like a counsel for the, he was on C-SPAN and he was being interviewed by Brian Lamb.
Uh-huh.
He's one of the guys who helped to create C-SPAN. Brian Lamb, by the way, was working for Nixon White House back in the day.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he was an operative. He was a right-wing operative. But anyway, and so he's interviewing the guy. I think it was a guy or a woman. I'm not sure. And so I call up C-SPAN, and I get on the air. I actually get on the air, and I ask the question. I said, I don't understand something. Washington, D.C. is the most heavily guarded city in the world. Okay, there are missile batteries all around the city. You have, I think it's Edwards Air Force Base is right there. And how come after the two plane, after the planes went into the two planes went into the Twin Towers, and this other plane is not responding and it's heading right for the Capitol, why didn't they do something to stop it? So Brian Lamb jumps in and says, so what are you trying to say? You're trying to say that they should have shot it. I said, what I'm saying is that there is an unidentified plane traveling, refusing to answer any of the communications, heading right for the Capitol and, you know, all the Capitol buildings. And you have the missile batteries, you have Edwards Air Force Base. Why weren't the fighter jets assembled, scrambled? You know, it's right there, Edwards, to go up and to stop this plane. Or why wasn't that done? Anyway, and then he cut me off. But, you know, the point I was making was, you know, come on. They allowed it to happen. They allowed that plane or whatever. Some people say it wasn't even a plane. I mean, you know, you've heard this, right?
And
I believe it too. I believe it. No, it was either a drone or it was maybe a missile, because it could never fit. It could never have fit through that little hole that the thing went through. A jumbo jet could never gone through that hole.
Yeah.
So, and then they took all the closed circuit television coverage in that area, like from gas stations. They confiscated all of it immediately.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so the public could not ever see what was coming into that building, because they took away all the closed circuit. So anyway, that's just one thing. There's so many. I'm not going to go over all of them because there's a whole bunch of them, but some of the key stuff. The morning of 9/11, NORAD and the FAA are having these games called Operation Vigilant Guardian. And what were the games? The games were about fake hijackings of jets. I'm not making this up.
I know. But it's,
so you're going to tell me Osama bin Laden or whoever was behind this, they got the information? Because that's not known. That information's not given out. That they're going to do the war games on the 11th? Because obviously if somebody's going to hijack planes, that's when you want to do it, right?
Right.
And you have the tapes of the air traffic controllers who are watching all this happening, and what you're hearing a lot of them saying, is that a real one or a fake one? Is that one there a real one or a fake one?
Yeah, right.
Okay. Yeah. Then you got the fact that the three planes weren't responding, you know, and two of them are heading towards New York City. And they know this not within 10 minutes. They know these planes are heading in that direction.
Mm.
So what do? NORAD, or I think FAA or one NORAD, they scramble jets from Otis Air Force Base in Massachusetts.
Mm.
When you have an Air Force Base, Andrews, in Jersey, over New Jersey, which is real close. Why did they not scramble fighter jets from Andrews? Why did they scramble them from Otis that they could have never gotten to New York City in time? And that's maybe that's why, right? They didn't get New York City on time.
Right.
So these are things that the public was not being told even afterwards. And you had to look and read the books or the investigations by independent researchers. And then, of course, Building 7, never got hit by a plane, and it's burning. The whole building is going. And you hear Silverstein, the owner of the World Trade Center buildings, he's on the tape saying later on the day, in regard to Building 7, he goes, listen, pull it. Now,
he claims
later he meant to pull the people out of the building. Is that how you would say it? Pull them out. When they take down a building.
Right.
That's how they say when they're going to take down a building. They say pull it. Pull it down.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, and he says his cockamamie excuse was, no, I meant pull everybody out of the building. And, of course, that building was where a lot of national security files were being kept, you know, a lot of files involving investigations, fraud investigations against corporations. They were all being held in that building, and they were all demolished, never to be found again. So, is this a coincidence? I mean,
really?
And then you have Bush Jr. sitting in the classroom in Sarasota where it's announced that he's going to be. It was announced he's going to be there. So, he's sitting in a classroom. On his way into the school, he sees that the plane went into the first building. And he made a joke, you know, because he didn't know. He said, gee, they should check that pilot's, they should check his license. And then he's feeding to the kids later, right? And the second plane goes into the second building. Andrew Card comes out, goes and whispers to him to tell him that the second plane went into the building. Now, you would think when the second plane goes into the building, Secret Service runs in, they grab him, and they get him out of that building, right? Get him out of there. Because everybody knows he's going to be in Sarasota that morning. Right?
Right.
Well, the terrorists can know that, too. It's all announced. How come they let him sit there for seven more minutes?
Yeah.
He just sat there. He sat there because they knew he was safe. They knew he was safe, you know. I believe that the inner circle, this is my opinion, I'm just giving you my opinion. You know, I have no facts to back it up. My opinion is that the inner circle in the know, in that administration, the inner circle knew about it, were involved in it. And the only one who didn't know was Bush. Because he was so stupid, they figured he would blow it, you know, because he can't act. And he would probably blow it. So they didn't even tell him. They didn't tell him. And maybe they told him later. I don't know. But when it was happening, the man did not. That's why he made the joke, because he didn't know. He didn't know. Because that's the kind of a president he was, you know.
Yeah.
You know, he was, Cheney was the president. Cheney was the president, okay? Not Bush. He was just it was like with, you know, Reagan. Bush's old man was the guy that ran things, not Reagan. They put Reagan out in front of the cameras because he was half senile. And they put him out in front of the cameras, and he said the nice things, and everybody liked him. But when it came down to that, all the nitty-gritty, he was just an actor. He was given lines, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So this is what I believe, okay? And will the truth ever come out? I don't know. I mean, you know, people still think that Lee Harvey Oswald, you know, pulled the trigger and shot John Kennedy.
Right.
After all the research and all the information, there's a lot of people still believe it.
Yeah.
So, yeah. You know, and Sirhan killed Robert Kennedy, and
mm-hmm.
James Earl Ray killed Martin Luther King.
It's just, yeah. Yeah.
They have a lot of, you know, when you're dealing with the national security state, or the deep state, that's the real deep state. They have a lot of, they have a lot of power. They have a lot of money behind them and power. And so I don't know what to tell you, you know, I mean.
Yeah, you're right.
And someday, you know, someday maybe it has to come from the inside, Chuck. Somebody from the inside has to blow the whistle on anything, you know, on anything that has happened. It's got to be people who are inside that had the information that have to reveal it.
Right, right.
That's the only way you're ever going to find things out.
Yeah.
So, you know, 9/11 will go down as...
Somebody does, you know, they end up going after them with a vengeance. I mean, look at Julian Assange.
Yeah, that's criminal, what happened to that man. I mean... He reveals the Apache helicopter attacks, and from then on, they just wanted him. And they got him. It's very sad. I mean, anyway, you have a good weekend, Chuck.
Thank you. You too. And
talk to you soon.
Next week. All right.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Sir, to you on the other side of the street, friend.
Radio at freedomslips.com, and we'll be right back after this message.
This is Thomas, a.k.a. a Mad Painter. I'd like you to join me Monday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time for Open Canvas. Don't forget to bring an open mind.
Yes, folks, that's right. Bring an open mind to an open canvas. Again, that is Monday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern. UFOs to government corruption. This is Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. You don't need to expect us. We're already here.
Interested in the paranormal, murder mystery, real natural law? Do you enjoy interviews with amazing guests? Then join Crypt Rick every Monday night, 6 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, right here on Revolution Radio. Studio A, freedomslips.com. Crypt Rick's iPhone, thank you. Welcome to the Crypt.
Join me at Revolution Radio, Studio B, at 11 a.m. on Saturday for free association, when we take a look at philosophy, spirituality, psychology, social issues, and geopolitics. It's every Saturday at 11 a.m. Eastern on Studio B at freedomslips.com.
Enter into a world unseen on Raven Star's Witching Hour. You will encounter eclectic topics from the realm of spirit brought into our matrix of truth. With your host, the Solaris Blue Raven, Solaris will bring you an array of unique guests covering topics from ghostly spirits to amazing anomalies, covert technology, UFOs, and shadowy global events.
And that's right here at Revolution Radio, FreedomSlips.com, Saturdays, midnight till 2 a.m. Eastern Time. Revolution Radio, where information never sleeps.
Let the magic rise.
Galactic Interstellar Council on Revolution Radio Studio A, Fridays at 2 p.m. Eastern. Join us as we traverse the starseed paradigm. As expressed in the time-space continuum that we know as the divine expression of love and light. Integrating this conscious unity into the galactic paradigm. So welcome all, both terrestrial beings and galactic beings as one. So be it. You're listening to Revolution Radio.
Thank you for listening to Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. Any commercial advertising you may hear in this program is of the sole discretion and benefit of the host of this program you are listening to. Revolution Radio does not endorse any commercial products, nor does it accept monetary compensation for on-air advertising of commercial products, nor will it ever. We are and shall remain 100% listener supported. Any product advertising on this program are considered used at higher risk, and Revolution Radio shall not be held liable for any claims or damages received from any product advertised within this program. Revolution Radio, where information never sleeps.
Thanks for listening while we take that short break here at Revolution Radio, FreedomSlips.com. And yeah, we're going to get back to your host.
Welcome back, everyone, to the New American Dream Radio Show. I am Chuck Gregory, your host. The next guest of the evening is Richard Flamer. Richard joins me in this second week of each month from Chiapas, Mexico. And I recorded my conversation with him earlier. So here we go.
Well, can you hear me now?
I can. All right.
How are you doing?
Oh, I'm pretty good. I'm a little bit banged up right now, but I'm all right. You saw my pictures?
I did. Yeah. Well, like they say, that's life in the fast lane.
Yeah, right? Mm.
Today I wanted to speak about words. Mm. How words matter. It's a fine line we walk in matter. Again, free speech isn't free in the Middle East. Free speech in Guatemala by the prosecutors of corruption can get one jailed.
Mm.
Free speech in Mexico can get you killed in Mexico.
Mm.
15 journalists killed since January of this year.
Wow.
In Turkey, declaring that the genocide of the Armenians can get you jailed.
Mm.
I think it's mostly about power or money. Even years after the fact, it is illegal to talk or teach of the rape of Nanking or the use of Korean comfort women as sexual slaves for the soldiers of Japan. I've written elsewhere about anarchy. I understand that any language is fluid, that over time words can assume different meanings, sometimes retaining a sense of the old. To speak of gay is a terrific example. Growing up, the word gay was used by those around me as a kind of lighthearted joy.
Mm-hmm.
in later years became a synonym for homosexual. I was wrong to assume the word was being misused. When I checked in the historic Oxford English Dictionary, I was surprised to discover that as far back as the 18th century, it had been used both ways, as a synonym for homosexual and a synonym for joy. But what am I to make of other truncations? I was last year castigated by a woman poet for my use of the word poetess. She self-righteously proclaimed she was a poet, period. In my youth, a male acting in Hollywood was an actor, while a woman involved in acting was an actress. These days, anyone who is acting is an actor. I cringe when I hear the word orientate, when orient is particularly suitable. Though the American Heritage Dictionary and the Oxford both include the two words in their tomes, it still offends me. My particular horror is a daily barrage of political language, and the misuse of words by politicians is not limited to the English language. Recently here in Mexico, the upcoming elections have generated a plethora of word mongering. In recent times, the Mexican adversaries are traitors of the country for opposing his most recent bill in Congress. The bill as written would nationalize the wind turbines and solar arrays and put them in the hands of the government-run electrical company. His reasoning for the bill is that foreign corporations are making money in the electrical production and then selling it to the government. His reasoning suggests that the contracts for the foreign producers were negotiated by his predecessor and hence must be a result of corruption. Now, in my mind, traitor, or one who commits treason, is a strong word. Men and women around the world, both historically and the present day, have been put to death for any suggestion of treason. I would also note that treason is a charge often leveled or used to silence critics by the autocrats of the world. Closer to your home, blasphemy is defined in the American Heritage Dictionary as any contemptuous or profane act, utterance, or writing concerning God, the act of claiming for oneself the attributes and rights of God. Blasphemy across cultures varies according to the dominant religion of a place where the blasphemy is uttered or written. In the world of the Vatican, in Rome, the idea of women priests is blasphemous. In the world of New York City and the arts, a few years back, the photograph of Andre Serrano titled Piss Christ was investigated for its blasphemy, yet no one was killed for those things. In the Wyoming of 1998, Matthew Shepard was a gay man who was beaten, tortured, and left to die, spread-eagled, on a barbed wire fence in the form of Christ on the cross. That's what I would call blasphemy. The case of the Satanic Verses by Salman Rushdie is another book of blasphemy. According, so it seems to me, an act of blasphemy for the faithful Muslims of the Middle East, is it seen as blasphemous in Europe or the Americas? Simon Maurer, an English author, has written a novel titled The Book of Judas, which calls into question the narratives of the New Testament. Is it blasphemous, or is it a new way to look at the narratives? D.H. Lawrence wrote a novella called The Man Who Died, questioning the nature of Christ and his return as a man with human sexual needs, who, according to Lawrence, becomes more whole as a human being. Or Dan Brown, who writes of the descendants of Christ. Are they blaspheming? Are these writers blasphemous? Should they be assassinated or should they be castigated? Is it not important to speak of the Gospels as secondhand narratives, Just think of the various translations out of Aramaic and Greek. Are they somehow sacrosanct? What of the Gnostic Gospels? Are those Gospels not included in the original gathering of the sacred books in the time of Constantine? And then there's the issue of free speech. Does free speech mean that I can demean the religion of another? Does free speech mean that I can lie and publish my lies as truth? Does free speech mean that I can harm others with my lies? Yes, for me, words matter. A poem can't stop a bullet. A novel can't defuse a bomb. But we are not helpless. We can sing the truth and name the liars. So says Salman Rushdie. Mm.
Wow. Some very interesting examples, and wow, what a difficult question. I mean, one of the things you asked, does free speech mean that I can lie and publish something as truth?
Right.
Yeah. We have people who used to be a big part of this show who have been in trouble for publishing what they felt was truth, and it's considered to be lies. I don't know. It's such a sticky problem. I lean towards the freedom side of things, but when it's doing great harm, it's pretty hard to justify it.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And the nature of things like blasphemy, I think about the Gospels and I've obviously read the various Gnostic Gospels as well, and the whole idea of putting together the Bible as Constantine was supervised. Mm. And so many of the books were left out, but then were they left out for ideological reasons, or were they left out because they were false? And the nature of translation also troubles me a lot. Mm-hmm. I have a friend who sent me a book called The Cotton Patch Gospels, written in the South. Mm-hmm. And it's in an argot of the South. And is it blasphemous? I don't think so. She says the Quran is made up of what some call fairy tales. And some, there's been really no, as I know, there's never been a reordering or a different version of the Quran. Mm. From that, which was published early. Mm. And the translations, I mean, who has done the best translation? Mm. And the whole nature of some words, some words just incite people. The nature of treason, for example, when I was brought up, I thought of the treasonous nature of something that's really, really serious and dangerous to the country. But people have used the term treason or traitor in terms of describing various prisoners of conscience these days.
Mm-hmm.
Especially Julian Assange.
Exactly. That was the one that came to mind immediately.
Yeah. And, you know, is that treason to publish the truth? I don't know. These are all questions which I think about a lot.
Yeah.
Of course, naturally, I don't have any answers.
Well,
but I'm just a local carpenter. Actually, I'm more like a wood butcher, but that's fine. I keep stumbling along through this path, although, to tell you the truth, I wish God would give me a roadmap, you know, some sort of way of struggling through that I could foresee the problems. But that doesn't happen.
Yeah.
We don't get a roadmap.
Sure. Yeah.
Well, it's always a pleasure. And I guess I'll talk to you next month.
Well, okay, Richard. You certainly gave us a lot to think about. I really appreciate it every month. All right.
Good. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Okay. Bye.
Bye-bye. All right. Well, quite a fascinating discussion from Richard Flamer. Our next guest, Frank Cordero, is also a Catholic worker, but instead of Chiapas, Mexico, he is in Des Moines, Iowa. Frank Cordero joins me each week. A little interview, and here's what we talked about earlier today.
Yo, Chuck.
Well, hey, Frank. All right.
Good to hear your voice.
Yeah. Good to hear you, too. Okay.
Yeah. So I am giving some thought to what I might start talking about. I have no idea what I end up talking about. The word fascism is now in the political arena, in the legitimate arenas, so to speak, airways. What's his name? Biden called the Trumpites in the Republican Party fascist, proto-fascist or pre-fascist or semi-fascist, mitigating, but the word fascism. And everybody's often talking about it. And I'm struck by how limited people understand the concept of fascism. I mean, it's a modern industrial age form of governance that relies on a strong military, and it relies on a strong industrial sector, rich people, corporations, and loyalty, blind loyalty and love for a nation. Nationalism now,
right.
And it could be a socialist thing, or it could be a capitalist thing, or it could be a lots of different colors and brands.
Mm-hmm.
I first used it when Morris Dingman used it, and he used it. He says, you know, because this is when he was identifying with the issues down in El Salvador. And he had visited El Salvador, he had brought Roy Bourgeois up was very much aware of the stuff we were aware of, involved in the Bishop Romero and stuff like that.
Right.
And basically, El Salvador is an agricultural country. And what happened was the local and indigenous agricultural systems were just systematically destroyed, and everybody was forced to work on plantation type stuff. Then when he says, you know, when only seven families own most of the land in El Salvador, that to me reminds me of fascism. He reminded him of that because he says, I grew up and was sent to Rome in the 30s, and I watched how the Italians and the Germans did it. And he was concerned that a type of fascism would happen in America because so few people controlled agriculture. You know, the so it's a and I'm I just assume that we're operating in a fascist, a Christian fascist country, with the kind of ideologies that are coming both from the left and the right, having to do with nationalism, America, wars that we fight. So it's a that we now want to point the finger at Trump's people who, you know, are just thugs, ugly, you know, street stuff, which, of course, is part of the history of fascism without mentioning, like, oh, yeah, by the way, a fascist system is a pro-war, pro-money, and pro-empire. I mean, that's just that's how the how empires are formed in the post-industrial age. So I find it interesting that we are using the word. I wonder if it will help us break through our the malaise that we live by. The you know, I'm convinced that this. This whole Trump experience, I for one, again, has continued to enjoy the national soap opera that comes on every night. I frankly don't know what I'm going to do if and when he does get indicted and go to jail. I mean, what are we going to watch? All that being said, the exposure, I'm just so, it's interesting to see everybody in this country now thinks half the country doesn't, is lied to. Now, if you're a Republican, you think the Democrats are being lied to. And if you're a Democrat, you think the Republicans are being lied to. But it's,
and,
they're now, they're,
if you
everyone
have any
is,
sense,
no,
you think everybody's being lied to.
Well, that's the point. The point was, the big lie was already bought and sold.
Yeah.
And and people are acting like, you know, why can't we go on a common truth, a common... common belief lives is when they're saying common facts, because it's all built on the post-World War II world. You know, we're justified by what we're doing in the world because we're good people and we saved them from what would, and what did we save the world from? Fascism. Sure. Yeah. Right.
So we...
All that being said, I'm and when I go through these things, I'm always kind of like, you know, I've been doing this Bible thing for so long. It's like it's instinctively. I mean, I instinctively lean into anti-wealth, anti-war, anti-empire points of view. Even and some would say I just make them up and put them there. But the I'm so taken by the response that the New Testament, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John do. To challenge the people who want to follow Jesus to lean into an anti-war, anti-wealth, anti-empire reality, because that's what they were living in, and I find the language, the biblical language, that's much more manageable and applicable than large system language. Like, you know, we could solve racism, but if we didn't change our attitude about wealth, war, and empire, we just do it without racism. I mean, I'm now, some people would say, you know, patriarchy is the culprit. You couldn't be an empire without some kind of patriarchal system. Okay. Right. But I find it easier to conceptually address if I know that there's a three front part of this thing. Wealth is the problem. War is the problem, and empire. That gives you the front upon which you got to engage the world and resist it. It's just some of my aimless ramblings here in the late summer of 2022 here in the heartland, carrying on the Catholic worker tradition, and it's. Who knows where this will take us?
Yeah.
How you doing, Chuck?
Well,
I'm doing okay. I crashed on my bike on Tuesday night on my way home.
Oh, you did it again?
Yeah.
Oh.
There's a picture on Facebook. My eye is very colorful.
Stop riding the bike.
I don't think anything's broken. It was at night. Fairly late, like 9:30 or 10. I was on my way home from an open mic, and there was a place in the road that I couldn't see until I basically until I hit it. And then I found myself on the road.
Oh my God. Did you get unconscious?
No.
You were conscious through the whole thing. You didn't hit your head.
Yeah, I was conscious through the whole thing. I did hit my head though.
Ooh, brutal.
But I was wearing a helmet.
Oh good.
And I decided I need to get a better kind of helmet. You know, this was one of the, you know, fairly lightweight ones, and I think it definitely protected me, but I'm looking for a full face one now, you know, like a, you know.
Do you need to ride your bike? Because
it's my only transportation. I can't afford to take Lyft.
Fair enough. I get it. All right. Yeah. And it's necessary. Yeah. I hear you. Yeah. I try to avoid them. I had a concussion when I got hit when I did my rack.
Yeah.
That was no fun. Yeah.
I'm pretty sure I don't have a concussion. But I have kind of road rash all over my left arm and some abrasions on my right hand at the heel of the hand. Yeah.
Oh, God, whatever. You were in trouble. You did something like this some months ago. Didn't you get some kind of a bike wreck and hurt yourself?
Well, yeah, something like that. This is actually the third time this year. Like that.
Yeah.
So I'm going to be changing. At night, I'll only use the trike. No, it's bigger. It's easier for people to see me. It's more, you know, resilient to road conditions.
So tell me, is your bike an electric bike?
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, cool. Yeah. Well, that makes sense in Florida.
And the bike was completely undamaged. You know, after I landed, I called up a friend who had just left the open mic at the same time. And actually, I didn't call her, but I Facebook messengered or whatever, saying, hey, I need help. And she came and found me and brought me home.
The
nice thing about this bike is it's really small, you know, it only weighs 30 pounds. And, yeah, so it fit in the back seat of her car, you know. So she brought me home. Of course, she's yelling at me the whole time. You shouldn't go so far at night.
Isn't it so neat that friends are willing to let you know their opinions about what's going on?
Exactly. You know, I mean, isn't that great? I mean, you know, that's what friends need to do. Friends need to tell friends when they are screwing up or whatever.
Screw up. Yes. Yes. Norman continues to be in the rehab scene. So,
okay.
People who keep him in prayer, it's hard to tell if it will be able to get him back or not. So he'll be in a surgery at the end of the month. We'll know more then. Yeah.
Persevering. I hope he will be able to come back to you.
Yeah.
So end of an era today, right? With the Queen Elizabeth dying.
Yeah, really. God, he was old.
I know. Hey, you talk about us being all bad. 96.
Yeah,
now that's up
there. Yeah, that's right. All right. All right. God bless the Queen, wherever she's at tonight.
Absolutely.
And may we not have any more. They're just not all the helpful. But, you know, to each their own. God bless them.
Yeah.
All right, Chuck,
thank
I got to go. Love
thank
you,
Thank you, Frank. Okay.
Bye-bye. Talk to you next week. Bye-bye.
Okay. All right. It's always a pleasure to speak with Frank Cordero. At the Des Moines Catholic Worker. All right. Well, normally I, in this second week, our final guest of the evening is Sheena Powell-Zuri. She was not available tonight. And M.K. Davis, who usually joins me in the third week, was kind enough to agree to fill in for her. So I'm going to add MK to the show right about now, and we'll see what he has to say. Right then. Go. MK joins me from Mississippi. He's an explorer and a specialist on Bigfoot and other things. MK, welcome to the New American Dream Radio Show. You're on the air.
Okay.
All right.
I want to talk a little about some Native American, particularly one particular tribe, nation. Was in Mississippi, no longer here.
Hmm.
They're now extinct, but they were here in great numbers when the French first came into Mississippi exploring. The French are the ones who wrote down a great deal about them in their journals, and that allows people like me to read and kind of get an idea of just exactly what kind of people they were, you know, how they lived their lives, what was important to them.
Mm.
You can't really tell those kinds of things from an artifact. Artifact that give you just so much, and a person who actually observes, and the French actually had people living with them and for about 8 years before it all turned sour. They were the Natchez Indians. And I don't know if you've ever heard of the Natchez, but they're considered to be kind of out of place Aztecs. They were Mesoamerican style in the way that they thought, the way that they did things, how they viewed life and death. And it's sort of an outstanding thing to me. I was dumbfounded by it. And I think the French were too. They didn't know what to make of anybody with, you know, beliefs like that. And right now, there's no more Natchez, as far as they know. A few of them left and went to North Carolina, I believe, and they got assimilated into some of the tribes on the East Coast. And there was one person who was going to come to the Natchez Festival last November that claimed that he was a Natchez, but he didn't show.
Hmm.
So we don't know. But they were. It was strange. What they believed. They had their chief, and they didn't call him a chief. He was above a chief. They called him, literally, they called him the son.
Hmm.
He was like way over the top authoritative. And they had a hierarchy in the tribe that ranged from sons, those who were right below him, they were also called sons, all kin to him. And then there were all the way down to, there were honored men. That's somebody who had done something brave in battle or some other way that had distinguished themselves. And then below that, there was what they call stinkers, which the lowest of the low, except that they even got lower than a stinkered. They adopted a group of people that they called Grigras. And nobody really knows what a Grigra was, who a Grigra was. They were not associated with another tribe. They just came out of the woods. And it's kind of interesting because Natchez has the distinction of being having the very first on record Bigfoot report in North America. It was 300 years ago, last November. And it they recorded it. The Jesuit priests that were missionaries there with them wrote it down exactly what they saw. It scared the daylight out of everybody in there. It was something that they all saw. But these people, the Grigras, it's kind of interesting to me because the Hebrew word for Nephilim, whom they, it's a biblical term for giant. I don't know if you remember in the Genesis account, it said they were giants in the earth in those days. Well, the word that they used for giant was Giga. Which is really close to Grigra. It's where we get our word gigantic. From Giga. Possibly maybe even Grigra. But I was really surprised and shocked. Now, the Natchez Indians built a mound called Emerald Mound. And it's right outside of Natchez, and it's the second largest mound in North America. It's 8 acres on a surface on top, and then they have another mound on one end that's for the sun, not the literal sun in the sky, but the sun, the chief. And then on the other end, way 8 acres away, was another mound for a lesser, probably the chief, what they call the chieftain of war. Well, he held a distinctive title too. But if the son were to die, well, first of all, let me talk about some of the celebrations they did. They would have what they call Festival of the Corn. And they had a little miniature granary, and they would fill that thing up, and then they would party all day long eating that corn. They couldn't stop until they ate it all out of it. That was the custom. And so they were just eating, and then they put a pole up in the middle of the little festival area there, and then the warriors would go and hit that pole as hard as they could with their battle hammers or I'm not sure what they called them, but to see if they could do some kind of feat of strength, you know, we were showing showing off. It goes on and on all day. And then when the sun would come, they would all get quiet. And then they would clap their hands 9 times and go, how, over and over.
Hmm.
Which is H-O-U. Well, that's how the French spelled it. And I don't know if you remember, but it's customary in the some of the stuff that I've read that it was common, not customary, but common, that Indians would say how, raise their hand and say how.
Yeah, sure.
But they weren't saying H-O-W, they were saying H-O-U. Mm-hmm. And what that meant, I don't know, but it was reserved for a special greeting. Something happened to the son, and he dies this natural death. He gets old, or so he gets sick, or whatever.
Mm.
Everybody, first of all, his wife was put to death with him.
Mm.
They would wait a couple of days, let her get ready, and then she would be put to death, and then anyone that was under her in that family, she had children, they all were put to death. And then it kind of spread out, and when one of the great sons died, there could be as many as 100 people died with him. And they would all execute him, you know, on these mounds. They had special cords that were made, and then they would take, tobacco, the leaf of tobacco, and beat it to a pulp until it was kind of a watery, pasty pulp, and they would roll it into a ball. They would make 3 balls, and they would make that person sit down, and they would put those balls in their mouth and get them to swallow them. And when they did, they would go into this catatonic state.
Hmm.
And when they reached that catatonic state, one person on one side of them, one person on the other, both holding that cord made for that. And they pull hard as they could and strangle the person to death.
Whoa.
And these people didn't do anything wrong other than to be associated with that person called the son.
Hmm.
They would pretend the son was still alive. They'd go up to him and say, we brought you something to eat. And then after a while, they would ask him a couple of questions. He's laying there, stone cold dead.
Hmm.
And then they would say, well, we can see that you must be dead since you're not answering our questions. You know, it's a ritual they went through.
Uh-huh.
So once they declared him dead, then they went to killing the others.
Hmm.
And it went all the way down to little children, little tiny babies.
Oh.
Choke them to death. The babies got choked to death first.
Mm.
Okay, and then they would move up to the different ones at different times. They would have whenever the parents of the babies came their time to be choked to death.
Mm.
They would already have their children already executed.
Mm.
And they would have them there. And their whole idea was that at the point of death, you immediately went to another place.
Mm.
Which is Egyptian in style. Mm. You know, that you went to the underworld, into another place, and you would need all of those things. You would need your wife, you would need all your servants, And that includes people who cook for you and do all the other things. So you're going to the other place with about 100 other people.
Whoa. Huh.
And the French were horrified at that. And they used their influence. They were considered to be, they were highly regarded by the Natchez.
Uh-huh.
They provided the Natchez with firearms and with ammunition. And the Natchez provided them with bear oil and stuff that was considered to be very valuable lubricants and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
They thought highly of one another at that time. And so the French would try to get the executioners to not put somebody to death. Someone they knew, had grown accustomed to and come to love and admire, and they didn't want to see him dead. And by the time they talked to him a little bit, they talked him into not wanting to die. You know, they were willing participants most of the time.
Mm.
But the French were able to do that, and so they were able to. They got one guy who says, "I don't want to die." And they had never, hardly ever had that happen. They all were willing participants. So they were a little puzzled by him, and two older women volunteered to go and be killed in his place.
Mm.
And then they ridiculed him, saying, "What, you know, go on, you woman." You know, they called him a woman. And he left, you know, in spite of the shaming. And they put the women to death.
Hmm.
And then the French temporarily left and went somewhere.
Hmm.
And when they did, they went and found this guy and put him to death anyway. You know, so it really didn't do him any good to try to talk his way out of it.
Yeah, right.
The Natchez had very little to do with any other Indian tribe. And that's why, because the other Indians were horrified at their beliefs and their belief system, you know, that required people to be put to death like that. The Natchez had 8 villages. They were well organized.
Mm.
And so they, you know, if you're wondering about 100 people being put to death, you know, they had a lot of people. They were one of the bigger nations of people.
Mm.
But eventually they ran foul of the French. And the French ran foul of them, and they attacked Fort Rosalie and Natchez and massacred everybody in there. Not that that was anything new to them. They probably didn't consider it a massacre. They probably considered it to be sending them to a better place. And then they went up to another fort that they had built, Fort St. Pierre, which was closer to me. Back up west of there, of Natchez. It was north and west, and they attacked it, and they got the Yazoo Indians to agree to help them, and they massacred everybody there. So it was the beginning of the end for the Natchez. By the time the French got through with them, exacting, you know, revenge, there weren't any left. The Choctaws joined with the French to try to get completely rid of the Natchez. They were all scared of them. They would go and they'd send a war party for just a little, no reason at all. and they'd come up on you at night, and they would try to massacre you. You know, if any one of the war party had any misgivings, they would all go home. They'd abandon because it was a spiritual quest. You know, aside from being a physical fight, it was a spiritual fight. And if anybody had any problems with it spiritually, then they would go home. They'd forget it, and they would leave a gift there for the other tribe to find the next day, so that they would know they had been their goose had been cooked and they didn't do it. That was life in Mississippi and Louisiana. Also, the Natchez went over across the river into Louisiana as well.
Yeah. Now you said that they're extinct now. When did that happen?
It happened sometime after the massacre at Fort Rosalie. That's the bluff overlooking the river there in Natchez. The remains of that fort are still there, the dirt works and stuff. All the other nations, and there were quite a few in Mississippi, were fed up with them. And the French were quite fed up with them as well after these massacres. So they all kind of put their forces together, and it just exterminated them. You know, there's none that anybody can verifiably, you know, say this is a Natchez, you know. But what kind of caught me by surprise was that way up north in northern Nevada in the 1840s, there was a Paiute chief by the name of Winnemucca. And his son was called Natchez. It was spelled exactly the same. And it helped me to appreciate or to realize that we don't know everything there is that was going on back in those days. I didn't know that they had buffalo in Mississippi.
Really? Buffalo?
Yes. The Natchez went on buffalo hunts. They used to hunt them all the way to the coast. But the buffalo had gradually moved north, and it took them, they had to walk for a day to reach a prairie, and on that prairie, the buffalo were still there. The prairie, I didn't know there were prairies. I thought it was all swamps and stuff.
Right.
But the Indians created the prairies. They had these buffaloes, and that was a big source of meat, a big source of hides, and so they began to burn chop down the timber and burn it and create open land. And it provided space for the buffalo. That's why by the time Europeans got here, there were buffaloes by the millions. The Indians were essentially, you know, creating the space for them and the grasslands. That all of that at one time was in timber. That's what you call, you know, terraforming. You know, you make it what
right.
you want to.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. You make it what you want to make it. If those buffalo were your main source of food, then you make it their life easier so they can reproduce. You know, and that's what we do now. I mean, effectively, we do that. We make pastures.
Yeah.
We cut down the trees and make pastures. And raise cows and make it where you can get a maximum amount of cows on a minimum amount of land. So yeah, they were just doing, you know, you call it conservation, I guess it was conservation. And some of the funny things that I thought were kind of entertaining was that a bear was a valuable thing. If you got a bear was full of oil. And you could boil him and render that oil. That oil was highly valued as a trade commodity, as a trade commodity, because there weren't any wells pumping oil out of the ground. The only oil that they had was natural oils, you know, animal stuff, and a bear was full of it. So they would walk through the woods, just the open woods, until somebody spotted claw marks on a tree. Because bears would claw the tree. So then they would climb up a tree close by and get a long bamboo or cane. And then they would tie a bundle of bamboo shavings onto the end of it and set them on fire.
Whoa.
And then they would hold it over the hollow of that tree. A bear would be inside the tree. And they'd let these embers fall off and burn the bear. And the bear would come out of there, and they were ready for him, and they would kill him. Wow. And then if there were any cubs in there, they would capture them and raise them.
Really?
They would raise the cubs. I guess they weren't big enough to be of much value. Cub is a little skinny, scrawny thing.
Yeah, sure. So they'd raise them and then slaughter them when they got grown or what?
Right. They'd get them good fat grown.
Yeah.
And then they would.
MK, that's the music. That's the music signaling the end of the show. Thank you so much for joining me tonight, filling in for Gina. We'll figure out what's happening next week later on. But thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right.
Appreciate it.
And listeners, thank you for being here on the American Dream Radio Show. I'm Chuck Gregory. Good night.
Revolution Radio every Wednesday 8 p.m. Eastern Time on Studio B for Momentary Zen with host Zen Garcia at freedomslips.com, the People Station.
This is Thomas, a.k.a. a Mad Painter. I'd like you to join me Monday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time for Open Canvas. Don't forget to bring an open mind.
Yes, folks, that's right. Bring an open mind to an open canvas. Again, that is Monday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern. UFOs to government corruption. This is Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. You don't need to expect us. We're already here.
We did not engage in conflict that was out of line with our mission.
Is it disloyalty? Is it sedition? Is it treason to oppose the hands of tyranny? Never!
I will never send troops anywhere on a mission of that kind without telling them that if somebody shoots at them, they can darn well shoot back.
I know not what course of...